the end of Ecclesiastes, Solomon says, with finality, vanity, vanity, all is vanity. He's saying that ultimately, all of life is hollow. Many people think that that's just the claim of an unbeliever, but that's not the case. Vanity, vanity, all is vanity, is the claim of each believer.
Welcome to Christianity at Work, a radio ministry of Mackenzie Study Center. Our hosts are Dr. Jack Crabtree and Christine Barber. Jack is a philosopher by training, but his real passion is the Bible, having studied and taught it for more than 25 years. He is currently on staff at Mackenzie Study Center and Gutenberg College in Eugene, Oregon. Christine is a licensed marriage and family therapist, having practiced in California and Oregon for over 20 years. She is employed by the Caris Foundation, a teaching and counseling ministry. In this series, titled Being a Christian, Jack and Christine discuss the most important biblical concepts of the Christian life. Now, here are Jack and Christine.
In the last several weeks and today, we're going to again look at what's it look like to be a believer? In other words, what should my life look like as a believer? And Jack, sometimes our lives look really messy. And that's, I think, something that kind of stays behind closed doors for a lot of people, that we try and look good on the outside, and the appearance is that everybody else looks good, and that we don't. Mm-hmm. And I think a really big part of an encouragement that I think we could give to people is nobody's life looks good. Not really, when you look into the core of it. All of our lives are really messy if you can look inside and see clearly what's going on there.
I think it relates very closely to what the point I want to get across today. The mentality that many of us have as Christians in our contemporary Christian culture is that the unhappiness and the emptiness and the brokenness and the frustrations that we experience in our life is due to our not being right related to God through Jesus. So there's a promise. Sometimes it's explicit, sometimes it's just implicit, but there's this promise that gets made by the Christian community that if you come to Jesus, everything is going to get fixed. It's all going to get better. Your life will be full and meaningful and rich and rewarding. There won't be any frustration. There won't be any emptiness. There won't be any futility to it. It's just all going to come together for you and be this great and wonderful experience like God wanted it to be, and that Jesus is going to make that happen for you. That's not true. That's not what the Bible teaches. The Bible's perspective is that this world that we live in now is inherently and essentially futile. It's frustrating. It's disappointing. It doesn't work the way that my heart would want it to work. And that's just the way it is. And coming to Jesus doesn't fix that. Coming to Jesus simply involves my getting some perspective on that and understanding that I was not made to find my fulfillment in this life and in this world, but I was created for something beyond this world, something bigger, something better, something grander than I'm now in, than the reality I'm now in. But because we have this other mentality, and we think and we expect that coming to Jesus should fix my life, we have a tendency to try to conceal from other people how disappointed and how I am, how frustrated I am, how futile my life seems to be.
And certainly I try to hide from myself.
Right, right. Yeah, we try to convince ourselves that I'm not experiencing what I'm experiencing. Mm-hmm. But I think it's rooted in this very faulty expectation we have about what it means to be a Christian.
You know, Jack, in a lot of ways, this idea that we have as Christians that everything should be made all better, that we should, in a sense, be cured of our disappointment, our frustrations, our anger, our anxiety, our fears, the messiness of our lives. It sounds a lot like what I hear out there in the general world, and that's that if you just look far enough, you're going to find the God within, and there's going to be a cure. There's going to be something that if you dig deep down far enough, you're going to find this beautiful core, and if you live in unison with this beautiful core, then life is going to be very good, and you can kind of look forward to that. So it really sounds like very much the same thing that I'm hearing out there.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think it's, if it's not the fundamental lie that we human beings believe, it's certainly one of them. The deception, the lie of Satan himself, that says real wisdom, true wisdom, is finding the key, is finding the secret, whether it's deep down inside of you or in Jesus or some other religion or whatever. But it's finding that key that's going to unlock the secret of life so I can make life work for me. From a biblical perspective, true and profound wisdom is having the light go on and I find, and I'm able to see with my own eyes, oh, I get it. This world just doesn't work. That's the wisdom I need to come to. I need to come to understand that I'm not going to be truly and fully fulfilled in this lifetime. It's not going to happen because it can't happen. And then the contentment and the rest and the peace that comes from realizing I'm not missing out on something I could have. I just need to patiently wait for the fulfillment that was never intended to come yet. And that's true wisdom, true biblical wisdom on this issue. But the lie of Satan is, no, if you just keep looking, keep trying one technique after another, go listen to one teacher after another, go find the guru, go find the philosopher who's going to tell you this is the secret to find happiness in this life.
Well, I remember several years ago I started working with a man who came in and he said, you know what my goal is? My goal is to be happy. I'm really unhappy now. My life isn't going well. I know I'm really making a lot of mistakes. I'm dealing drugs. I'm, you know, fast with women. I'm doing a lot of stuff that I know is wrong. And this person didn't in any way consider themselves to be a Christian, but just did, though, see that they're doing a lot of things that were hurtful to them, and they thought they were causing problems, and they were kind of stuck, and they wanted to be happy. And that's kind of the goal that they had in mind. What a goal.
Yeah.
So,
very understandable, however.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And over a period of time, actually, I worked with this person for quite a while. This person's come to say, you know, in fact, last week, this person said, you know, there's no way I was going to end up being happy here, because as we look more and more at the center of my life, there's just more and more hate, there's more and more hurtfulness, there's more and more jealousy, I'm just seeing all of that more and more. And he said, there's no way that I'm going to find my happiness by trying to get rid of that in my life, because that's just there. And the deeper I look, the more I see. He said, though my happiness is coming out of a recognition of the reality of things, rather than trying to pretend like, for example, I'm not jealous, I see that I am, and there's some stability in that. There's some groundedness in that. I'm not happy about that. It doesn't feel good, but at least I have myself. I'm grounded. I don't feel crazy anymore. I don't feel like I'm up off the ground and don't have any anchor. I have an anchor, and I'm standing in it, and I'm finding a real contentment in seeing the reality of my life, even as it unfolds in a really hard way. And that, Jack, is really the paradox, that in seeing who I am, there is a sense of well-being, and it is peace, I think, that Jesus is talking about in the Bible. That we're not fighting with ourselves about who we are and what the world is like and who God is, but we know. And you know, the exciting part of this is, this man said to me, you know what? I think that I need to know about God then, because I need to know about being loved. Now, you've cared about me here. You've, Christine, seen me and accepted me and cared about me through this. And I want to see who God is, because I think I need the love of a God that's really big, as I see the depth of my own hurtfulness. He isn't calling it sin. He doesn't have Bible words, but he said, and then he said to me, how do I find out about God, Christine? Oh, my heavens. What a day. I think the angels danced in my office.
Wow.
It was wonderful.
Well, the sort of thing that you're talking about, we'll talk more about that in the future. All that you say is really perfectly true. I think for a lot of Christians, however, they will readily and easily say, yep, my sin really spoils things, and my sin really gets in the way. what it took me years and years to see, though, is that the Bible is saying something even more controversial than that. And that is, even if I could live a sinless life, this world wouldn't work. That there's something wrong with the world itself. It's just, it's a crazy place. It's a backwards place. It's full of ironies. The righteous get punished and the sinner is rewarded and succeeds. You know, how many psalms have David or the other psalmist crying out, God, why are the righteous getting eaten up like food while the sinners prosper?
I guess in my kids' words, it would be, God just isn't fair. The
right.
world just isn't fair.
It's not fair at all. It's very unfair. Exactly.
And
exactly.
It really goes against what we think should be.
Right. And that's what we want Jesus to come and fix. And yet, wisdom is, no, God created it to be this very unfair, frustrating, unrewarding. The word that Ecclesiastes uses is something like futile. This futile place that we live in is something to endure and to persevere in and to be the classroom in which I learn wisdom in order that I can be prepared for that blessing in the future that is going to be all my heart's desire. It's going to really fulfill me.
And that will be ultimate fulfillment in
right,
heaven.
Right.
And yet, as I said, in using this example of this man that I worked with, is there is quite a bit of peace, and in that sense, fulfillment, and a recognition of reality and living in that right now. In fact, I think that's where joy comes from.
Right.
So I don't want to totally erase the fact that here and now, we have something that's really quite valuable, and that's a peace of mind.
Right.
And that's a sense of understanding and valuing God's grace in contrast to my own sin. Those kind of things really do have a deep substantive meaning in our lives.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. I like the way you put it earlier, that it's a kind of groundedness where we're grounded in reality, we're grounded in truth, we see it the way it really is, and there's a tremendous amount of stability, emotional and psychological, spiritual stability that comes from just knowing that I know what this is all about.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, joy, peace, all of that is very apt descriptions of what we can have here, but it doesn't measure up to the full blessing that my heart longs for.
Well, actually, I hope it doesn't measure up even close.
Yeah.
Okay, so Jack, a lot of people would say in the Christian community today that we're all wet, that really what this world is about isn't about gaining wisdom to understand what life is about and looking forward to the hope of eternity, but they'd say that today is where we're supposed to be looking at and finding fulfillment. And they would say that we're really falling short of what's available to us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't know if I can, in just a brief, succinct kind of way, make a case that would be convincing to anyone if they don't already see it for themselves. There are a couple of things to point to. Jesus said, for example, he taught, don't lay up treasure for yourself here on earth where, and I won't get this right, but where thieves break in and steal and rust and moths destroy, whatever. But lay up treasures for yourself in heaven where those things don't happen. He's clearly speaking into the context of the reality that this world is corruptible. Things get destroyed in this world. Things don't last in this world. Things are disappointing in this world. I can't keep whatever this world has to offer me. I'm not going to be able to keep it. It's just going to go away on me. But there is a place that's going to be everlasting and eternal and incorruptible. It's not going to fade. It's not going to decay. It's never going to be destroyed. Invest my life in that, he's saying. Don't invest your life in the stuff that can't possibly last. I mean, I don't know how else to take that teaching. That seems pretty clear on the surface to me. So he's teaching out of that very perspective that I'm talking about. He doesn't say, I mean, his teaching is not, this world is corruptible until you come and believe in me, and then it gets transformed into incorruptible. He's just saying from the outset, come and follow me in my perspective that we have to invest our lives in something above and beyond this world. Because this world is not going to cut it.
Okay, somebody, I'm kind of following my line of thinking here for a minute in terms of people saying that this world should have you know, a lot of good stuff happening, and we really shouldn't just look for heaven by and by, but we should really find it here. They would say, for example, when they're feeling down or something difficult has happened, that what they need to do is to find the joy of the Lord. And that they might sing a song, they might sing praise hymns, they might, do something that just, I think, in their words, would be worship God in a way that's full of exclamation points. Mm-hmm. And then they would feel better, and they would feel closer to God.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm sure that's true, and that's a little bit difficult to answer because, yes, they should find the joy of the Lord. That's true. My only question is, what exactly do we mean by that? What does it mean to find the joy of the Lord? If what they mean is music is emotionally uplifting, or I have some control over my state of consciousness so that by focusing sentimentally on God and His love and what He's done for me, I can give myself an emotional uplift, that's also true. But that's not really the joy of the Lord in any profound sense. Somebody else could meditate on Buddha or the One or something like that and probably accomplish the same thing in their life. There are all kinds of stimulants to my emotional joy that I can utilize to kind of give myself a rush of some kind, a sense of happiness and joy. But the futility of life that the Bible is talking about is how ephemeral that is, how passing that is.
How temporary it is.
It just, you know, I get there, and then it's gone. And the after effect is to go, oh, wow, all that work, and it's gone.
I'm sure that lots of people don't say all that work and it's gone. They sing again. They go do something else that stimulates their emotional high so that they don't end up feeling bad. And I think they really, I don't see that necessarily as, I think most often it probably is just an emotional stimulant. But I think they would say that they are worshiping the Lord and that it's really very helpful to them in their spiritual life. So let's go back to, what is the joy of the Lord? What does that mean?
Well, I think the joy of the Lord is what you were talking about earlier. It's the deep understanding that penetrates into the deepest levels of my being that says, here's who God is, here's what reality is, here's what God is doing in my life, and now I know what my life is all about. I know what its meaning is. I know what its purpose is. I know where I'm headed. I can be content now with a world that is really kind of futile and disappointing, but I'll hang in there. I'll be content. I'll persevere because I see what God is doing and I understand what He's doing. I don't need to make this world work for me now to be content. I don't have to go out and find meaning for my life somewhere because I understand what the meaning of my life is. There's a tremendous amount of wholeness that one experiences and one feels when they come to that level of understanding. It's the joy of the Lord because it's the joy that's rooted in who the Lord is and what He's doing.
But Jack, to get there is the difficult part. Let's take this person that wants to sing joy to the Lord. Let's say, for example, that this person just was involved in witnessing the divorce of their best friends and people they'd spent a lot of time with. And all of a sudden now there's this split, and it makes a big difference in this person's life. Their friends have split up. It changes their life a lot. They're sad for this other person. And they just say, okay, I'm just going to sing joy to the Lord. I'm just going to praise the Lord in the midst of all this. And on one hand, what I think is, well, why not sing? That there's perhaps some value in doing that. But really, the path that they must go down in order to get this more substantive and grounded peace or joy that we're talking about is to face squarely into the losses that they're going to have to experience through the divorce that their friends have gone through. They're going to have to enter into that with their friends in their own heart.
Yeah, especially in their own heart.
And they're going to have to think about, is God good, maybe?
Right.
What went wrong? Is the world fair? What's this all about? It could create enormous questions in their life and disequilibrium to go through that kind of unpeace, disequilibrium, insecurity, confusion, lack of understanding just seems futile. It seems like all I'm going to end up with is this big mess of unfaithfulness because I'm going to wonder and be confused about who God is and what life is about. So instead of doing that, I'll sing joys to the Lord. Singing joy to the Lord feels like faith to them. It feels like I'm not going to question God. I'm just going to go here.
Yeah, it may feel like faith to them, but it's actually the antithesis of faith. It's actually a kind of running away from truth, running away from wisdom, and therefore running away from God. Because what God wants to do in my life, what God is attempting to do in my life through these trials and through these disappointments and through these sufferings, is to teach me what my existence is really all about. I don't come born into this world understanding that. I don't have that kind of wisdom to start with. I have to grow in wisdom as I watch my life and face it honestly. And that's the crucial issue, face it honestly. So if I look at the divorce of my friend and I see that as this devastating tragedy in this life, if instead I think Jesus wants me to be happy all the time, even in the face of tragedy, then I don't understand the depths of the tragedy that life is. And if I don't understand that, I don't understand this world. And if I don't understand this world, I don't understand the creator of this world. And if I don't understand the creator of this world, I'm not getting to know God. And I'm missing the whole point of my existence. So I don't think it's an innocent mistake. I don't think it's an innocuous thing to try to turn my sorrow into joy through an artificial stimulant. I think it's the height of foolishness. It's the opposite of wisdom.
And yet that person may have to suffer a great deal and go through a lot of confusion in their life in order to find this kind of substantive peace. It isn't fast earned.
No.
It's slowly, slowly earned.
And indeed, I don't think we're ever done learning that as long as we're in this world.
You don't think so?
No.
We know so.
Yeah.
I mean, I think I can say that I know that that will never be done in my life. I am astounded by the things that keep happening in my life that I just have to learn. And it blows me away how much there is. So one of the marks of a believer is that we come to understand who God is, really see Him clearly, understand that He's good, that He's love, that He's more real, He's bigger than anything else, that He's the only God. Those are things we talked about before. And I think a little bit more today we're talking about that a believer has a growing understanding of the world and other people and of ourselves. So Jack, can we focus on a believer has a growing understanding of God's creation?
There's really two aspects to it. One is the one that we've been talking about, and that is that this world is fundamentally futile. I think that's the message of Ecclesiastes. I'll come back to that in a second. The second one is that the world is passing away, that it's not permanent, that it's not going to be here forever. It's going to go away one day. So even if it were not futile, it's not permanent. But not only is it not permanent, it's also fundamentally futile. And I think that's the meaning that's the message of the book of Ecclesiastes. If you recall the phrase that he keeps using over and over again, I think our translations usually have vanity, vanity, all is vanities, or futility, futility, all is futility, something like that. That the idea is it's like breath, has no substance to it. It has no, it's kind of hollow, the hollowness of this existence. And what Solomon explores in Ecclesiastes is all the ways in which life promises so much and delivers so little relative to what it promises. We could hope for financial security, but financial security is so fragile and it goes away. We could hope for excitement and happiness in my life, but my happiness always seems to turn to boredom and tedium. The same thing that was really exciting to me 15 years ago just makes me yawn today. It's just old, uninteresting to me. You know, what is it about life that even when we find these things that fill us with joy and happiness and excitement. And in the height of that, we go, oh, if I could only have this feeling forever and experience this forever, if I could only prolong this moment. And only to find that when we do prolong that moment, it's not interesting to us. It just doesn't have the same effect on us. Those kinds of issues is what Solomon's exploring is throughout his book. The statement in there that I love the most is he talks about pursuing hedonism, pleasures of all kinds, wealth and wine and song and women and just pursuing all kinds of pleasures. But it says, in all of this, I kept my wisdom, I believe is what it says. And I've often reflected on what that means, and I think I understand what he's saying. He's saying, as much as I was living a really debauched life in a way, there's two ways to live a debauched life. You can live a debauched life and not watch what you're experiencing, not really pay attention to what you're experiencing. Or you can live a debauched life kind of unthinkingly. And I think what he was saying is, I was reflective and awake and alert and watching myself experience life in this debauched pursuit of pleasure.
And debauched.
Kind of outrageously unprincipled and undisciplined and just, you know, if whatever felt good, pursue it and try to do it.
Mm-hmm.
But what he noticed is how unsatisfying it was. What he noticed is how empty it was. What he noticed is the only way to live that kind of life, as you described it earlier, if the pleasure or joy begins to phase, then you go to the next one, and the next one, and the next one, and you've just got this endless string of attempting to stimulate your emotions to some kind of happiness or joy. But you have to keep going. You have to keep going to something else, because whatever joy that you're finding to stimulated by the pleasures that you're pursuing, that doesn't last. It's just so futile because it goes away on you. And that's what Solomon in his wisdom noticed, is that there's got to be more to life. This is absurd. This is ridiculous. If the only way to find happiness is to keep frantically looking for the next pleasure, that can't be right. There's something very unfulfilling about that. And that was his conclusion at the end of that, is that it's all very futile, isn't it, if this is all there is to life. And then he goes on to explore other aspects of life and says, in the final analysis, life under the sun, is that how he puts it? I think that's the phrase he uses. Life under the sun is just empty, hollow, futile. It's all futility.
He goes from one subject, in a sense, to another and tries to wring it out for its good, what right. He can find that might be valuable to him and have lasting value. And every time he finds them unfulfilling.
Right.
And he goes to the next one, and it's unfulfilling, and the next one, and the next one, and finally he says, vanity, vanity, all is vanity.
Right.
Kind of the final analysis.
And I think a lot of Christians miss the message of Ecclesiastes, because they look at that book and go, well, that can't be true. That can't be right. He must be talking about life outside of Jesus. But when we come to Jesus, all this changes, and this book becomes totally irrelevant to us. But all I would say is, we need to open our eyes. We need to have the wisdom that Solomon himself took into life. Look at our own lives. Our own lives as Christians. Our own lives in Jesus. Isn't what he's describing exactly what our life is like under the sun? Because Solomon's description is not, here's what life is like outside of God or outside of Jesus or outside of righteousness. He said, this is what life is like under the sun. And I think what he means by under the sun is in this material physical existence that we're in right now. Granted, he's not talking about my ultimate destiny. He's talking about this life right now. But this life right now, no matter how you cut it, no matter who you are, no matter what you believe, life here and now has this hollowness to it, this emptiness to it, that is not going to be fixed now.
Well, you know, it doesn't have this hollowness to it if I can stimulate myself away from knowing that. If I can
remain foolish.
Yeah, ultimately I remain foolish, but I don't think I am. I'm going back to the person who wants to sing praises to the Lord as a way to make them feel better, and to them it feels like faith. But if they can sing enough praises and keep that up and do enough things that make them feel good, then they don't feel this hollowness that you're talking about. And Ecclesiastes truly doesn't make sense to them because they're able to override over and over and over again that sense of futility. Now, and I'm amazed about it sometimes, Jack, how well we can stimulate ourselves away from reality. I see people who are on the edge of catastrophe in their life, or who have catastrophe in their life, who have horrible things happen, and they're still not willing to look at the reality of their lives. They are so invested in keeping the picture of the world that they want that they will not let go. They will not talk about things. They will not deal with things. They will not work on things that are brought right in front of them. You could put a card that says, look, right in front of their face, and they simply will not, because they're so incredibly invested in having the world look the way they want it to look, being in control in the way they need and want to be in control. They are clenched fist, tight-jawed, holding on to it, and yet not seeing that, thinking perhaps that they are in faith pursuing the Lord. And that is a scary thing.
Yeah, it is, because those people are not described, as Solomon is, as keeping their wisdom with them. They're not keeping their wisdom with them. They're not watching. They're not paying attention. They're not alert. They're not thinking. They're just going through the motions, trying to live on the surface of life, and not get deep enough into life to see the futility and emptiness that's there. I think probably most Christians would agree that if four different sets of people at a party, at a fraternity party or something, where everybody is getting drunk out of their mind and just having a really uproarious, outrageous time, you could have two people who are interacting with one another and conversing with one another, who are living on the surface of their life, just talking about trivial things, trying to reinforce in one another a sense of happiness and a sense of joy and, boy, isn't this a great party and aren't we having fun? You could have two other people who get into a conversation where they start looking at what's happening in themselves and around them and say, isn't this kind of pointless? I would hope that we as Christians would agree that those people are closer to the kingdom of God than the first two. Those people are paying attention, and they're recognizing the absurdity of this way of investing your life. They're noticing that. They're paying attention to that. They're experiencing that. They're feeling that at some level. They're really feeling the hollowness of it. And we would applaud them for that kind of wisdom and that kind of realism, that kind of insight into their circumstances. The problem is, bring it now into a Christian context, and we're not consistent, because if you'd have two sets of Christians who are doing church together, and you have two Christians talking, and they keep back and forth using platitudes to talk about how happy they are, how happy it is, how meaningful it is to be in Jesus, and how much they love Jesus, and how much joy Jesus brings them, and how wonderful their life is now that they love Jesus, and they're just back and forth trying to reinforce that attitude in one another. Take two other Christians who are saying, you know, this life is really a drag a lot of times. It's hard. It's difficult. And I'm not sure I understand it yet.
And they may be sharing issues in their lives that come up that are difficult for
them. And confound them and confuse them. Yeah.
They may be having a difficult time with their children. They may be having a difficult time with their marriage. They may be saying, I really want it to be better. They're not necessarily down in the mouth, but they're talking about the reality of what's going on in their lives and saying, help me out. Share that burden with me. Listen to me. Mm-hmm. That's the kind of thing you're talking about. Not necessarily people just being depressing.
No.
But people
no.
being real.
Just being real and realistic and honest about what it is they're experiencing and what they're feeling. Well, who are the wise people in that context? In the context of the party, we know who the wise people are. Well, who in the context of the church are the wise people? I would argue it's the same people. The people who have their eyes open, who are awake, alert, and who are paying attention to what life is really like and their experience is really like, rather than the people who are just trying to not have to look at things.
Who are trying to not be real,
right.
actually.
Right.
Who are, in essence, not being honest. And yet, Jack, I need to come back to, that's a very honored way of being in the church today.
Oh, I know.
It's very honored. And what we're talking about is going to be spit on. Do you realize that? That people must be very, very angry as they're listening to us. Because people are honestly in good, or as honest as they know how to be, and as with as much as they know, thinking, those platitudes that you're talking about is really what I'm like, and I'm trying to be doing what's right. I'm trying to worship God. I'm trying to be positive. What do you mean, putting that down?
Well, these are life and death issues, and we can't afford to, I don't think we can afford to just kind of be diplomatic about this. What's so dangerous about that is that...
No, you're not diplomatic at all.
Okay. But what's so dangerous about this is that it's a kind of self-deception that leads us to ultimate destruction if we're not careful. We can sing all the praise songs in the world. We can say praise the Lord all we want. That's not what I have a problem with. As long as I keep my wits about me, as long as I look at life the way it really is, and I have that heart within me that wants to be realistic and wants the truth, whatever that truth is, however much that truth may not match my wishful thinking, however much that truth may be contrary to the way I would like my life to be. If I have that heart that is wants to understand and grasp the truth before God, then I don't care what we do. You know, I don't care how many practices we have to promote joy in my life. Those then become innocuous. That's true. What I'm concerned about are the people that trade the one for the other. Don't bother me with the truth. I just want to be happy. Once again, in the context of the pagan world, those are exceedingly shallow, silly people who just live, who just skip along the surface of life. And they'll walk away from any conversation that begins to get too serious, because they can't handle it. They refuse to handle it. They don't want to look at life very deeply. But in the church, are those people not also silly? The people who walk away from the conversations that get too serious and sober, they are shallow people and silly people, not wise people.
That's quite a parallel you're drawing. People in the church who are saying things that don't look at reality, and people at a party who are looking at things that don't represent reality. I can imagine you have a lot of tomatoes being thrown at you right now. And I'm thinking, yeah, we're not being diplomatic at all. And I do agree with you. These are very much life and death issues. And I have a real huge heartbeat about this and really press for it in my life and certainly in my work as a counselor. I am very much pressed to help people feel better and really have my job on the line all the time. Will anybody come back to me if I help them look at reality? Will I have an income if I do that? And that's been a tough question for me, and one that I've had to hold to in a very significant way, in a way that could cause me to basically lose my income. And as we're talking right now, I'm thinking this conversation could make us lose our voice in our community and throughout the Western United States, where this radio station is being heard. That people do not want to hear this. They don't want to hear that the direction they've been going in may need to be reconsidered. But I would submit that to our listeners out there. Please reconsider what we're saying. If it makes you angry, well, what's that anger about? Why are you angry? Is it because we're not telling the truth? Or because possibly there's also something you don't want to hear and it interferes with the way you want to believe life to be? And listeners, I'd really ask you to send us a note about this. Talk to us about what you're feeling and what you're thinking. Ask us some questions. I'd encourage you not to get angry and talk to somebody else, but get angry and send us a note so that we can address these thoughts, because I am very, very committed to what I'm saying here today, and as I know you are, Jack, and would like there to be more light put on this very subject. Let's go for it, guys.
Yeah, you're in a much better position to know to know how people might react. In the circles in which I circulate, this doesn't even strike me as all that controversial. I mean, the people that I'm rubbing shoulders with and talking to every day, I think would agree with me about all this stuff. It doesn't even seem all that strange to me.
This is not your soapbox. This is mine.
But you confront a lot of people from a lot of different backgrounds and a lot of different churches and a lot of different communities. So you'd be more in touch with that than I would.
Majorly. And you know, one of the things that really gives momentum to this for me is that I see a lot of people hurting other people by their need to have things look and feel fixed and right and cured. In order for me to feel good, I have to make you change in some way. And it can be a radically hurtful thing that I'm doing without even seeing it. But I see that happening all the time, Jack, and especially by Christians who I think are very well-meaning. If they want the world to look a particular way, to look like things can be cured and fixed and right and fine, and so they don't have any kind of resilience to understand another person's life, another person's understanding, to be able to bring truth that someone else might be offering them into their life. It's a dramatically difficult issue that I experience in many, many people's lives. Maybe every person I counsel.
Hmm. How do they integrate that with their Christianity? I mean, I can see how people would, you know, they just want to be happy, and to be happy, I need my environment the way that I want it to be to promote my happiness, and you're part of my environment, so I'm going to somehow try to control you, and that's where the hurt comes.
Yes,
right?
Yes.
How do Christians look at that? I mean, what are they thinking?
You mean how are they doing it? Or
well, but also how do they justify it? How do they?
Well, they're not justifying.
Oh, okay.
They're seeing it as right. They're, for example, if I'm a Christian and I come to my Christian friend and say, I am really struggling with depression in my life. I'm really having a very difficult time. I don't know where it's coming from, but I'm floundering. I'm in the middle of the ocean. I can't find the dock. I can't find an anchor. And I'm scared. Well, my Christian friend, who thinks that that should never happen in a Christian's life, and really believes that, might say to me, what you need to do is just get on your knees and pray 3 times a day. You've just got to do that. You've got to show up at the church. You've got to never miss church. You've got to sing praises to the Lord. Here, let's sing. Sit down and sing together. Let's pray and get the devil out of your life. They're not thinking they need to justify that. They're thinking they are doing absolutely the right thing for their friend who's depressed. Now, certainly praying is a good thing. Certainly, in context, singing songs is a good thing. I do it. I sing hymns. I love hymns. They remind me of who God is and who I am. I love them. Certainly going to church and having fellowship with people. But I think what you were saying before is I substitute that for looking at the reality and truth. Honestly, in my life, I have lost big time. In fact, I may have lost everything. But can you see how it can happen right. In a very well-meaning and subtle way?
Right. So the destruction that you were talking about is sharing my deception with them and leading them down the path of deception. Here, handle it this way. Trade off wisdom for living here on the surface of the Christian life.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And that's kind of in a subtle way that's difficult. The person who's depressed thinks, oh, gosh, maybe I am going in the wrong direction, and goes toward their friend's direction, or they may just get more depressed because they need support and help to look at the reality of what's going on in their life so that the depression can be worked through and come, you know, they can get underneath it and do some work that will help them work on the issues in their life that are bringing that about, which may be moral issues that they really do need to look at, or maybe issues of seeing God or themselves wrong or the world wrong,
right.
And they need to have a new mind. Where it can get more hurtful, Jack, is when, for example, I come to you and say, you're my really good friend, and I come to you and say, you know, Jack, I have seen your son lying, and I've watched in this context and this context, and Jack, I really think that you need to take a look at this. And what you do to me is say, how can you judge me? How can you say such a thing? It's wrong for you to say such a thing. Because you're invested in seeing your family as being perfect, as your son as being perfect. So you don't want to see him as a liar. So you tell me I'm wrong and I'm bad and I need to stop. And what you do is go pray for me.
Okay.
So what you're doing is doing what looks spiritual and good. But the reality is you're not looking honestly at an issue that may be huge in your life. But because you're so invested in your son looking a particular way, you won't look, Jack. You won't listen to me. Okay, I see we're almost at the end of our time. Can you help us summarize what we've said today?
Well, we've got into a lot of different issues, but the general point that we were trying to make comes down to this, and that is, as the Spirit of God goes to work in my life to sanctify me, to set me apart, to make me look like a different person who marches to the beat of a different drum, there are different things that happen. And in the past weeks, we've looked at how the Spirit of God brings about a growing understanding of who God is, a desire to know who God is, and an actual understanding of who God is. What we were talking about today is how the Spirit of God comes into my life and begins to bring about a growing understanding of the real, true, essential nature of the world that I live in here under the sun. And specifically what we are looking at is my growing understanding that this world is fundamentally hollow and futile. It was not created to satisfy me, to be my ultimate blessing and my ultimate reward, to be that thing that would ultimately fill up my life and my existence. God never intended for it to be that. And so it's essentially lacking in its ability to do that. When I come to see that, then, I stop trying to wring meaning and fulfillment and happiness out of this life. And I grow in my contentment that now is the time to learn to see. Now is the time to learn to understand the truth, and I will wait for my fulfillment when God decides to give that to me in the age to come. And that contentment that comes out of that understanding of this world, and the wise choices that replace the foolish choices that comes out of that understanding of the world, that's an essential part of our sanctification.
The staff of McKenzie Study Center has written a book on interpreting and understanding the Bible. It is what they call a common sense approach. They believe the Bible communicates God's wisdom to us in normal human language, and this requires us to be good readers. This also means we need to see each of the biblical authors as trying to communicate a particular set of ideas to a particular audience. But this is not always easy. In fact, it's hard work. What is needed is a set of godly principles to guide us in our interpretation. The authors of Biblical Interpretation, A Common Sense Approach, offer a reasonable guide to those principles. Call McKenzie at 541-485-4801 to order your copy.
Jack, I keep a whole set of Christianity at Work tapes in my office, and it's really been a great ministry. Very often when I go out into my waiting room after I've seen somebody, there's somebody kneeling down at the bookshelf and choosing a bunch of tapes and taking them, and it's got quite a circulation now, and I'm very thankful for the opportunity to have the issues taped that we've brought up here. Issues on marriage, issues on sexuality, issues on what is it to be a Christian, singleness. So many things that people find very important and very practical in their lives. And they have very much appreciated the perspective that we've been able to share. That just thrills me. It warms my heart. In order to continue our ministry, we really need to ask you, the listening audience, for continued financial support. But I think an important question that you all need to ask is, what kind of stewards would you be of our money? And so it would be important for us to give you some information about that. About 70% of the money that we use each month is used directly to pay for the radio stations. I think it is 9 stations. Thank you, Tucker. Actually, the man who records for us just let me know. But the issue, again, of stewardship is a very important one. Jack, can you just educate us a little bit about that? It's a word that's used a lot.
Yeah, I think there can be a misconception about stewardship, that we tend to think of stewardship, at least I do, tend to think of stewardship as being efficient. But I think that misses the heart of what stewardship is all about. Stewardship comes from the term that's used to describe an old-fashioned term for a manager, that wealthy people in the ancient times, say in New Testament times, wealthy landholders would have a slave or a servant who really was their business manager. I mean, just did their life for them, did their financial life for them, invested their money, paid the employees that needed to be paid, paid contractors that needed to be paid, fed the other servants and slaves, and just basically managed all of the possessions of the landholder.
Kind of took care of it all.
Took care of it all, exactly. The money belonged to the master, but the money was managed by the steward. And what Jesus was trying to teach us is that's how we should think of all of our financial resources. Our finances do not belong to us. They belong to God. And God has entrusted us with that portion of financial resources and material possessions that he's put in our hands. But it's not so that we can have it. It's not so that I can think of it as mine to do with as I please. Rather, it belongs to God. And I must do with it as God pleases.
I'm kind of the secretary of God's money.
Exactly. Yeah. So what that means is, and what he was trying to teach us is, that we always need to be thinking in terms of, here's the resources that I have at my disposal. Why do I have it here? Because God entrusted it to me. Why did he entrust it to me? Because he wants me to dispense it in a way that reflects his values and his priorities and his interests. That is, he wants me to do with this money, he wants it dispensed the way he wants it dispensed. I'm not to spend it on my own selfish desires just for the sake of spending on me. I'm to do with it as God would have me do with it. Now, where we can get in trouble is we can think, well, he doesn't want me to spend any money for my own upkeep and my own maintenance and for giving a luxurious gift to my wife or husband, yeah, or for my own enjoyment. Well, that's just simply not true. It's consistent with God's values and God's priorities that he would want me to enjoy it. But that's not all he wants me to do with it. And so the important thing to understand about stewardship is I must always be asking myself the question, I must always be confronting the reality that this is not my money, it's God's money. Therefore, the question I must ask myself is, what are his values? What are his priorities? And in light of those values and priorities, how would he want me to invest this? How would he want me to dispense it?
You have been listening to Christianity at Work, a radio ministry of McKenzie Study Center. If you would like a free copy of this program or would like to know more about McKenzie Study Center or Gutenberg College, you may call us at area code 541-485-4801. You can write to us at 1883 University Street, Eugene, Oregon, 97403. And we're also on the Internet. Look for us under McKenzie Study Center or Gutenberg College. If you didn't have time to write all that down, I'll repeat it again in just a moment. The McKenzie staff has worked for years studying the Bible, understanding the world we live in, and pursuing what it means to be a Christian. They desire that their ministry may be valuable to others, but they also know that their efforts are in deep need of God's mercy. You can join the McKenzie staff through classes, seminars, tapes, and papers. The McKenzie Study Center is a nonprofit ministry entirely funded by the generous contributions of people who believe in its goals and have benefited from its ministry. If you would like to make a gift to McKenzie, it will be entirely tax deductible. Just mail your check to McKenzie Study Center, 1883 University Street, Eugene, Oregon, 97403. If you would like to call and request a free taped copy of today's program, the telephone number is 541-485-4801. Now on behalf of Dr. Jack Crabtree, Christine Barber, and the other staff of McKenzie Study Center, thank you for listening.